What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariano. We call him Day-Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Everybody, welcome back to the Grim Malkin Lane podcast, where queer friends and allies gather to review and discuss the original X-Men comics in continuity order. I am here joined by the incredible powerhouse team of Tom Brevoort and Mark Russell. What a joy to have you both back on the show. And we're going to be reviewing an issue in the latter half today called Marvel Team Up number 38. This is weirdly an issue that like five different guests passed on. They're like, can we do something else after reading it? But I think it's really delightful, and I'm really happy you're both taking this journey with me. This is an early 70s Bill Mantlo Beast story that I think has a lot of fun moments, actually. Let me have you both introduce yourselves to our listeners, if you will, with your pronouns, tell us a little about you. And my intro question for today, very simply, who would you choose to have a cup of coffee with? Beast, Spider-Man, or the Griffin? Let's begin with Tom Brevoort. Tom, welcome back to Grey Malkin Lane.
Thank you very much. I'm Tom Brevoort. I'm a conductor of X and Marvel executive editor and master of the Marvel arts and all sorts of other things.
These are the things that get listed under aliases in your handbook profile.
Yes. In terms of your question, I would probably have the cup of coffee with the Beast.
You'd have interesting psychological. Is it because you both have beards?
Not specifically, no, although that's always a plus.
Let me also welcome the wonderful writer Mark Russell back to the show. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Chad. Thanks for having me. Pronouns he, him. I am the writer of X-Factor, as well as many other titles. And my answer to the question is that I would probably have coffee with Spider-Man just so we could talk about the death of journalism.
Lastly, I'm Chad Anderson. I use he, him pronouns. I have ADHD mildly. I do pretty well. I'm a therapist, right? Like I gotta use listening skills and note-taking. I'm very organized. But I've discovered when I have clients with ADHD also, it can be triggering because they just will talk. You can never get a word in. I'm not a speed talker like that. But both Spider-Man and the Beast, they need Adderall. they have so many words for so many things. I think I would choose to interview the Griffin. I'd be fascinated by the surgical procedure of, you know, having lion paws and a mane grafted to your face. There's a lot we'd have to discuss. So coffee date for each one of us. We are set to
all
go.
All right.
That'd be a great series, by the way, just having a therapist break down the needs of each and every, you know, like hero and villain.
I cannot do character analysis without thinking of psychology and the impact of trauma. It's a place my brain goes quite often. Any character I'm reading. So whenever I'm doing an academic trial on the show, Tom, you did Franklin Richards with me. I'm like, all right,
right.
Talk about the psychology of how this is going to play out because it's always a fun place to go. So it's really fun to have you both here. You're a year-ish into the new run of books. Things have been up and running for some time. There's a lot of X-Men books coming out, some new things starting, some old things ending, and some really big things coming up along the way. I know there's always new announcements and things to hype, which is always really exciting. Tom, we're going to open in just kind of the broad-based place of how are things going a year in? Are you where you thought you would be?
I think things are going generally pretty fine. I know there's certainly a focal, what I have to think of these days as a pro-Krakoa contingent who were unhappy that the books, that X-Men pivoted away from the Krakoa experience and who seem to take no end of delight in the fact that certain titles are coming to an end. But that was always going to be the case. We launched a whole bunch of different things and tried a whole assortment of different flavors of X-themed stuff at the start of this whole thing. From the beginning, I said fairly consistently to people, not all of this stuff is going to click and going to work. And in fact, maybe none of it will. Who can say? We're making it up as we go. But that all having been said, I feel like the group has done a good job of carving out a new post-Krakoa landscape for the assortment Sorted X characters, and has done a really good job of working collaboratively with one another. So on by that score, I think we're doing all right. And hopefully, you know, we'll learn some stuff from the things that we did or tried this time as we try new stuff going forward. You know, maybe our batting average will get slightly better. Or if not, hopefully it won't get any worse.
It's an interesting thing as a fan who is interfacing with a lot of people who are working on the books, right? Like, that's my weird little niche over here. There's this kind of era of very enthusiastic creators doing a lot of things, and there's no guarantee that a book's going to run past a certain point at any time. But as you're kind of throwing the pasta to the wall to see which pieces are going to stick, and you're kind of forming a new group, a new team, seeing what pieces come together. I think it's fascinating to watch how it's all playing out. I'm going to go to the Krakoa place. We're going to start there. And Mark, I'm going to have you take this question first. Krakoa was a complex time, of course, but it was a mutant nation. And Tom, I had you and Jordan on to kind of talk about the end of Krakoa on quite some time ago in what might be the most listened episode of my show of all time, because it hit at a time where a lot of the Krakoa lovers were grieving, I think, a little. If we look at a nation of kind of, bro, we're going to do things on our rules. We're going to live in our own space. We're going to take up as much room as we like. The parallel between that and kind of the fractured universe the mutants are occupying now, where human oppression is such a key thing in all of the books. It's like a thing we just have to live with. Like, everybody hates us. We're probably going to get attacked no matter what we do. So do we hide? Do we stay small? Or do we try to fight back? Which is kind of an odd parallel to what's happened between the Biden and Trump regimes for queer people in this country, who were like felt a little bit of room at the table, and now they're being actively discriminated against. I think the grief people are communicating. There's my therapy hat, right? I think the grief people are communicating as we watch one thing shift to another is kind of an odd parallel of what's happening in the world as well. Mark, you're taking all of this and telling truly horrible things happening to really hilarious people in really comedic ways. But this like idea of mutant oppression as kind of a playing piece, what's it been like to craft the world of X-Factor in this post-Krakoa era?
Well, I wanted that to be sort of the centerpiece of X-Factor, sort of the dysphoria that this group feels after having their nation pulled out from underneath them like a cheap rug. Like the idea that there's different approaches, like you say, like people have very different ideas of what it means to be a mutant. No, we need to remain separate from the human world. We shouldn't join in their institutions because they're just co-opting us, versus the mutants like Havoc in X-Factor, who are like, no, we need to show that we're good citizens, and we need to like do some service to the human nation so that they will see that mutants are not a threat to them, and then they'll accept us. And I think that's an age-old question. That's a question that, you know, a lot of civil rights leaders sort of debated in the 1960s. And so I think it's not something that's unique to the mutants. It's something that's always gone. And to what extent should you assimilate into the society you live in versus forming your own sort of separate culture and not, you know, giving your oppressors like any sort of free space to like in your head? And, you know, it's not an easy question. And you can see where both sides have an argument on that. But again, it's ultimately about how you do not really change power from the inside. It changes you. So I think whatever your answer is, wherever you fall on that spectrum, it's like whenever you're playing ball with an oppressive autocratic regime, or whenever you're trying to ingratiate yourselves to people who genuinely hate you, it's not going to make them like you. It's just going to make you more useful to their agenda. And I think that's sort of the takeaway. But it was really good to have a launch point, to have like sort of a theme to build on. Not to say that every page deals with that theme. It is ultimately, you know, like fun comic. Like, I mean, it's like a lot of funny events, and it's more than anything a soap opera with, you know, these characters and their lives colliding. But having this sort of resonant sort of background theme really helped give it a sense of purpose and a sense of like design. This yeah. is like leading to something. So it was extremely helpful to like have that as a starting point to build the X-Factor series.
So on my show early on, we cover the first appearance of Bolivar Trask in the Sentinels. And, you know, he kind of martyrs himself because he had his mind changed. You know, like, I did this horrible thing and I have to sacrifice myself. But Trask is written as kind of repentant in the end. We're getting to the show now in like 1975 to the first appearance of Stephen Lang, who is just a ranting, insane maniac who's taken over the Sentinels, right? At a certain point, that ranting crazy person gets replaced by the cold awfulness that is like William Stryker, who is this like very evil church leader who's using the weaponization of belief to turn people against someone. As we're reading the comics today, and I know this is a very quick comparison, we're watching writers like Mark, as you're writing characters like Roger Broderick and General Mills, or we're looking at Gail Simone doing Karina Ellis, where these characters characters who are very cold and evil are being treated with a certain level of seriousness, but you're not making them anything but awful. Like, they're truly terrible people who are using mutants as fodder and torture and experiment. Tom, what's it like for you to see these villainous characters incorporated among the heroism that are the X-Men?
Well, you kind of can't have heroism without something to contrast against. And certainly living in the world today, there is no dearth of examples of people not being quite as upstanding and good-hearted and generous and empathetic as we might like them to be. So I think it's really just kind of a reflection both of the, you know, the moment we happen to find ourselves in, and the fact that for the heroes to be the heroes, they have to be in opposition to characters that are not wired the same way that they're wired.
Yeah, well, like Tom said, it's like there's got to be the other half of the conversation make your point about what, you know, what that truly looks like. And I think that, you know, having like characters who are, I think one of the points I wanted to make with villains and X-Factor is that just because somebody's ridiculous doesn't mean they're not dangerous. And I feel like Roger Broderick's obviously kind of a funny character, and he's glib, and he's trying to run a social media empire based upon the exploits and eventual deaths of the X-Factor team, which is sort of a comical premise, but it's horrifying too, because it's like this is what they represent to them, is the monetization of their own sort of abuse.
Balance of ridiculous and evil. I will say this, you guys don't have to, but if we look at nearly anyone in government at this point, it just feels insane. It's so crazy, the people in power of various places and the underqualifications and the ridiculousness in association. RFK, for example, good Lord, the man had a brain worm, and we just laugh about it. Like, what else are we going to do? Like,
well, and I think it's okay to laugh at something that is clearly ridiculous. But we have to remember that just because it's ridiculous, it's not dangerous. And also, you know, I think it also helps to laugh at it a little bit, to recognize that it's ridiculous, because it makes you feel like, well, surely we can do better. Surely we can beat this.
So I'm going to toss some just random questions. We're going to jump all over what's currently happening in the X-Books. And I'm going to talk to you both about a few different things. So Tom, tell me about the decision to resurrect Lilandra Narimani.
Well, we resurrected Lilandra. We did that sort of in service of stories that haven't come out yet, so I'm going to be kind of cagey about it. But
Imperial, least, I'm very excited for Imperial.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. At the very least, I guess from my point of view, I never thought that her death was terribly warranted. It felt like one of those, oh, we'll bump a character off just for momentary dramatic effect without actually thinking it through. I kind of think she's a keystone piece. She's the connection point between the X-Men and all of the Shi'ar Empire stuff that goes on. And once you sever that connection, you really don't have a good reason for any of that Shi'ar stuff to touch the world of the X-Men anymore. There's no personal connection to the Earth other than it's a planet like a lot of other planets, and there's some stuff going on there, but there's stuff going on in a lot of other places. So it was really that personal connection between her and Xavier that brought those two spheres, those two worlds together. And so, you know, we're going to kind of not just in the resurrection of Lilandra, but in the fact that she and Xavier have headed out into space and will clearly be doing some stuff during Imperial and so forth. We're going to kind of try and repair that bridge a little bit so that the involvement of stuff that goes on in that section of the universe can more easily and more readily intersect with the worlds traveled by the Assorted X characters in a way that kind of makes sense. I think there's not just in X-Men, but in comics in general, there are a lot of characters that got killed off in the moment for a momentary gain that with a moment or two's reflection, you kind of go, oh, that was probably a net loss rather than a net gain. You know, the classic one from years and years and years ago was Aunt May. Aunt May died. Great, great story. Great anniversary issue. But after she was gone, like, nothing else was able to step in and fill her role in that strip, so that people that came later decided we're going to undo that death. And they did it in maybe the most absurd and ridiculous way possible.
It was a soap opera actress who they hired to pretend to be Aunt May, who happened to be dying at the same time.
Yeah, it doesn't really make a bit of sense, but the end result of that nonsense was you had the piece back and who could fulfill the narrative need of that series. And every good Aunt May story since then, reflects that. So this is kind of, at least in my head, like that. I don't even remember all the circumstances of where Lalandra got killed and how she was written out, but I know that it seemed very ill-considered to me, at least looking back on it.
It was War of Kings. The Fraternity of Raptors offed her, and then Gladiator had to step in. It was very...
Right.
It was like a Darkhawk story, which was crazy, but it was a huge shocker. I remember reading it at the time. I'm a huge Xavier head. I love the character. I know him well. I love Lalandra. I love that he's taking this selfish moment in this kind of post-world for him. But also, I think Hickman is my favorite Xavier writer. I think he gets Xavier the best. So I'm really excited to see him write Charles in Imperial. But Mark, I'd love to hear your thoughts on turning Genosha into Gig Osha. You're using a lot of really fun, like modern tech in your series. And that was a wild, I'm like, okay, it's a barren wasteland after being a mutant homeland, after being a slavery capital. Then it was like all the zombies for a while. But now it's Gig Osha.
So I wanted to update it a little bit, make it more present in a world that's about to be overrun by artificial intelligence. So it becomes like the first algorithm. It becomes the next wave of horrible ideas, which is an algorithmic republic, which is a country that is ruled by algorithm, where the laws are constantly being updated, you know, minute by minute, based upon this algorithm that nobody really understands. That's like trying to find the optimal like legal structure, the optimal sort of like state for to run the lives of the people. When you go there, you sign, when you migrate to Gigosha, you sign a release, the user terms on Apple.
This is the worst episode of the Black Mirror, by that I mean it's the scariest version.
Yeah, you consent to like periodic upgrades. And one of the things you agree to is that if in a time of national emergency, they can use the implant that they use to keep you updated on all the new laws that are happening every minute to basically override your free will and force you into service to protect the country. Basically is a way to like digitize the zombiehood of the entire country and turn them into like cannon fodder in defense of the fatherland. And as we see, it happens pretty early on in the existing ocean. So it really was, to me, just the metaphor I wanted to make for the danger of over digitizing our government and our way of life. We have a constitution, not a terms of service, for a good reason.
I'm kind of assuming that you used to have nightmares about that little clippy guy from Microsoft Word. You have your clip AI now.
Back when I had an office job, he was like, I wouldn't say my arch nemesis. He was just more sort of like the comic relief who was never funny. You know, it's just like, do we really need this character? Can I just edit him out of my existence?
It's really fun watching the casts of characters getting assembled slowly in the other books. Tom, I got to interview Jed recently, but I didn't get to ask this question. We did an episode on Wire on my show recently, and it was crazy that Wire is now part of this group 3K. There's this long-term plot forming where we seem to see, it's Cassandra Nova and others, who are activating mutant powers in human characters. It's like a fourth species kind of riff off the old John Sublime stuff. Do you want to talk about the building plots with 3K and how it may intersect with the major threats in the other titles?
Well, you'll certainly see 3K become a much more active and a much more front burner situation as we go into the second year of the books. Again, it's difficult to say too much because there are things that are going to be happening in the next couple of issues of X-Men and a couple of other places that'll start to turn a few cards over. We haven't even entirely revealed who all the assorted leadership of 3K is. So there's still plenty to be revealed there. What I can tell you is, you know, you're not far off. There's certainly a group that has a very specific objective in mind and a very specific agenda in terms of achieving that objective. And we're going to see that become much more front burnered now that we've put a lot of the architecture into place and you know, set some dominoes up across the field to play out over the course of the next year.
It's interesting watching these threats develop. The Karina Ellis, Gray Malkin prison story, we still don't know who Prisoner X is. Plus the mystery that is the Hag over in the Gail Simone mm-hmm. titles, or Sarah Gaunt. Which threats are you excited to have like revelations given about? What are people going to lose their minds over?
Well, hopefully they'll lose their minds over a lot of different things. Most immediately, there's a bunch of 3K stuff coming. We maybe did just by virtue of luck of the draw with how some things fell. We probably did more Gray Malkin material more quickly than we'd intended to at the start. It was just there are often outside forces that affect the timing of some of these things. I wouldn't necessarily have planned to get as deep or as far far into certain things as we did, but that was just the way the cards happened to fall. So I suspect you'll see a little less of her in that situation for the next couple of months. But you know, really, I'm kind of interested in all of it and some stuff that you haven't really seen yet. Like the big thing, we haven't released anything on just yet, but it'll be big by the end of this calendar year.
That's exciting. I know we have all the giant size stuff with Kamala coming out, and there seems to be some really large things. Nyx, by the way, was really incredible. Just the allegory of peaceful coexistence, the interpretation of the dream. I think it's really fun seeing different writers take over that. I'm finding myself confused at the origins of the Hag. Sarah Gaunt and Gail Simone's book, there was a bunch of flashbacks to Sarah meeting Charles Xavier and then having a baby, but it wasn't his, but she thought it was. And then she died in a swamp and somehow got swamp powers and is now after Charles. I'm wondering if we're going to see more of this character. I was really baffled by the way the origin played out.
Okay, well, I'm sorry you were confused or befuddled by it.
We can call it curious.
Okay, certainly not every piece of that has been showcased yet. And yes, we will get back to her again, and you will see her again as Gail moves forward.
Yeah, Gail writes a creepy villain. I really enjoyed that part.
Well, thank you. Again, we'll get deeper into that when she's not spending her time in a Gray Malkin cell, you know, and is more actively on the page again.
When are we going to learn who Prisoner X is? I'm guessing it's Legion. That's my supposition.
All I can tell you for the moment is in the future.
To be revealed.
Yeah, that's the most difficult part with all of this stuff is I can't give you a lot of hard answers. I can't even tell you about the thing that's going to be happening towards the end of the year. In a few months, in a month or two, you'll certainly start to see some of the edges or outlines of it as different stories pop up. But even trying to keep track of when this episode is coming out versus what's on sale
and what's been announced and what will be.
Yeah, doing all of that on the fly, I have to kind of take a less is more approach so as to not accidentally ruin a story point for people.
No spoilers expected. I'm not trying to lay any traps here, I promise. Mark, you've been exploring the mutant metaphor through a couple of key different lenses. I would love to have you do a comparison on kind of the three primary viewpoints you're offering in your book, which is Havoc versus Polaris versus Darkstar. And they're kind of different ideals about the dream or coexistence. It's a really interesting parallel. And again, it's kind of comedic, but there's a lot of deep layers too.
Yeah, so, and I think a lot of them are sort of like parallel to like the way other populations have dealt with this question in history. But yeah, Havoc's view is that like we need to show that we're good citizens. We need to show the humans that we mean them no harm and choose the best human civilization, which he thinks is like US, because that's what he's familiar with, and like make sure that they win so that some other more authoritarian or less benevolent society doesn't take over. He feels like it's the best of the least bad options. He's sort of the lesser of two evils kind of. Polaris is like, no, we need to chart our own course, and we will never be accepted in the society, and we will never they will only co-opt our service to oppress us. And so she's sort of more of a separatist. But then Darkstar offers like a completely different idea, which is that like they are our inferiors and we should be ruling. And her idea is to like create like a mutant mercenary service that will then basically determine the outcome of every human conflict. That if they have like, if mutants control like their own labor in terms of like fighting wars, then they will tip the scales in favor of whichever human nations they decide they want to work for or non-government actors. And in doing so, they can sort of manipulate world events, put themselves basically in charge of the planet. And so those are the sort of the three different philosophies that we should be our own nation and respected as like our own entity, or that we should integrate entirely and be respected as friends and neighbors of the humans, or that we should, that the only way we'll ever be respected by them is if we hold the leash that controls the human race. And those are sort of the three philosophies that have war here.
And we can watch some of the characters even kind of flopping back and forth between ideals based on how they're feeling or what they're going through or what they've just been through. It's smart, and it's written in this comedic way. But your book, I always like to like capture a tone. I want like a soundtrack and like an energy when I'm reading a book. Like, so when a book's come out, you know, 9, 10, 12 issues, I want to sit down and read it all at once and figure out like, oh, am I watching The Wire or am I watching Schitt's Creek here? You know what I mean? And your book has that like a little bit of that like Veep energy where it's like that dark comedy.
I think that would be probably the one I would suggest. It's probably closer. It's probably like more of the family tree of like Veep or maybe one of the other Armando Iannucci like Death of Stalin type of thing than The Wire or Game of Thrones or something.
You're writing some characters that are historically very serious in some very comedic and almost tropey kind of ways, but it's fun to see these. The one I'll use as an example here is Cecilia Reyes, who's a very serious character who's just all makey-outy with this like one dumb white boy that she can't seem to get over. Has it been fun for you to kind of discover the sides or personalities of these more serious characters?
Yeah, I think the one thing I really have always loved about the X and the Marvel Universe in general is that it's not really about the powers. It's not really about the power sets. It's about the people. It's about the characters who happen to have powers. And so that's the way I wanted to approach this, that these are first and foremost people with their own sort of, and their desires and their needs are kind of what determine what they do, not their power sets. Their power sets are just there. In fact, their power sets are a lot of times like an obstacle to them living the lives they want to live. So I really wanted to like give her more to do, like more things that she just wanted.
Tom, you could have predicted that I would ask this question. I love the old continuity and I love these like corners that people haven't really picked up on. I'm so excited about Sarah Gray coming back in the Phoenix book. It's such a little thing, but Jean's sister, we've only seen that relationship played up just a little bit, and I'm so excited about the potential of that being explored. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that upcoming storyline?
Well, again, much like Lalandra, I think the death of Sarah Gray, and not even just Sarah, but then eventually like every other Gray-related person on the planet, was one of those story choices that I think in retrospect was maybe a mistake. I like the idea of Sarah Gray. I like the idea of Jean having a sister who's not an all-powerful mutant, but is just a person. And that gives you a human grounding on all of the sort of larger-than-life superheroics and issues that the X-Men are constantly dealing with. So it wasn't my idea to bring Sarah back, but when it was pitched my way, I was sort of very open to it simply because I like our characters having connections. I like them having relationships, particularly with more ordinary people. I tend to think we're at our worst, not just the X books, but Marvel Comics in general, when we're doing what I think of as dynasty stories, which is to say that everybody in the comic is a superhero of some sort. And so they have their super problems and talk about their super problems with their super friends as they're having super brunch. And there's nothing that relates to the life of a genuine human being to be found anywhere in it. This is all, you know, part and parcel for the reason why we set up a bunch of the various X groups in different places around the globe, was to give them the opportunity to begin to interface with regular people again, and not just a civilization of all super guys on a super island in the middle of the super Pacific. So Sarah Gray is kind of an outgrowth of that. I don't want to say too much about how she's back, why she's back, other than to say that like the stories in which she was killed, she isn't even really killed on camera. She's killed off camera between an X Factor appearance where she goes on TV to denounce, you know, anti-mutant bigotry, and then showing up again a couple of years later as the thrall of the Technarchs. Yeah, she didn't even get a really good write out. It was sort of like somebody she slipped through the cracks. Somebody forgot a plot point somewhere along the line or something. So all of that gets touched upon at least and delved into as we get into the questions of how is she back? Why is she back? What does this mean? And it gives immediately a more grounded emotional connection for Jean, who has mostly been off in space dealing with sort of larger, more cosmic consequences over the course of the previous 10 issues, to now facing a situation that's much more intimate and much more personal to her. We'll also see some background. We'll get some flashbacks to the two sisters growing up and get a better sense of their relationship. And I think the solicit's already out that shows that Cable will come in into the story at a certain point. So there's sort of another familial connection there. So rather than, without losing the scale of the first 10 issues of Phoenix, it'll be a somewhat more personally driven story than we've seen before.
I'm really excited about it. Sarah, I know Claremont was considering making a mutant in the early X-Factor run when that was being launched. I also know Sarah has two mutant children, right, who have been killed since she's been gone. She and Candy Southern were both kind of sacrificed to the Phalanx. And if that means, if Sarah's back, that means maybe Candy can come back. I'm a huge Candy Southern head as well. We'll just hope for good things. But I'm really excited about that storyline. Mark, what's it been like to be part of this new group of X-Slack? The writers all working together in this giant universe with so many pieces.
It feels like you're pulling onto a freeway and all the cars are going like 80, 90 miles an hour. I have to be honest, it's a little daunting. So I feel like the way I kind of deal with it is just sort of watch and learn. Just sort of watch them all like drive in traffic and just kind of intervene when I feel like there's an opening or when I'm needed. But yeah, it's been a real education because that's not typically the way I work. I don't really usually work in a collaborative writing environment like that. And seeing how other people navigate it, it's been really, really interesting. I think the thing I took away from it more than anything was just energy and the passion people bring to the characters and how that sort of fuels the collaboration. It's infectious.
There is a diverse lineup of X writers like there never has been. Lots of women, lots of people of color, people writing the characters they should be writing in some ways, right? Not that everybody doesn't have access to all characters, but it's really fun seeing female writers writing female characters, for example. There's a lot of really powerful things going on. When we compare, Saladin Ahmed's Wolverine to Erica Schultz's Wolverine, it's in the same universe, but completely different vibes and stories. It's fun to have so much going on. We're going to transition here in a moment to the issue review, but do either of you have things you'd like to bring up based on our conversation so far?
I not specifically, honestly, other than, I thank everybody for their attention and patronage, and hopefully people have been more enjoying than not enjoying, or at least finding something among the many flavors of X that we're trying to put forward that is to their tastes. Hopefully we'll continue to do that and even get better at it as we go.
I'm excited about it.
And I feel like I just want to mention that the first volume of X Factor, Please Like and Share, is out in stores now, just came out. And I feel like a lot of my readers are trade waiters. So for those people who are trade waiters, go get it.
It's a great book. And I love that everything is a different vibe at the same time. Okay, we're going to transition here into our issue review. This is an old Marvel team up story. I love this book. So when I was in high school, I've shared this story on the show before. I'll be really quick here. There was some abuse happening in my home. My stepfather found that one of the ways to punish me was to deny me the ability to buy comic books. He forbid me to buy, and they were literally my escape from reality. So I've told this on the show before, but I was 15 and I got a ride to the comic book store, and I was like, there's abuse happening in my home. I need comics. Can I work here a Saturday a month and you can pay me in comic books? And the owner of the shop agreed to do so. By the end of high school, I was working in the store full time and I was getting paid in comic books hourly, which for him, I'm now realizing was maybe some sort of odd tax evasion tactic because he got a free employee, but it allowed me to bolster my collection. So I was buying books all through the 90s, but I would kind of discover one series at a time as I would use my store hours to pick things up. Finding the old Marvel team-up books I thought was so fun. You never know who was going to be paired together. Today's issue is just kind of a fun, easy, done-in-one, super buddies fighting a villain kind of story. There's some problems with it, and there's some really interesting horror aspects to it as well, but it's a solidly good story. This is Marvel team-up number 38. It's from October 1975, and the writer on this book is Bill Mantlo. Tom, did you ever work with Bill prior to his accident?
No. Bill had his accident before I came into the business.
So Bill's a brilliant writer. So much great characters, soap opera drama. His work on so many titles is indelible. I've read a lot of his Alpha Flight recently, and boy, is there some crazy shit in there. He's really talented. We wish him and his family well. Sal Buscema is on pencils. Mike Esposito and Dave Hunt on inks. Janice Cohen on colors. Gaspar Saladino, Karen Mantlo are the editors, Karen being Bill's wife, and Marv Wolfman as the editor. This is a really fun team. I know a lot of the people are still around. Some of them are departed. Tom or Mark, do you have any comments on any of the members of this creative team?
This is very much, very early Bill Mantlo. It's one of the, I think, one of the earliest stories that he did. And I'm almost certain, staring at it, looking back at it again, that essentially it was pitched as a fill-in. There's no connection to any issue around it. It's completely a bottle story. It is doesn't even have a lot of connection to anything that might be going on with the characters elsewhere, apart from in dialogue, there's one reference to, oh, aren't you in the Avengers now? Yes, I am. Let's move on. So at this point, Bill was kind of in the formative stages of figuring out how to do what he did. And the story kind of underlines that, because you were very kind to it a moment ago when I chat, and I don't at all believe you were being facetious, but to my eyes, this it certainly fills 20 pages pretty good. But there's not a whole heck of a lot of substance to it.
It's like a Saturday morning cartoon episode, kind of, but it's fun. I told you a bunch of people passed on this one before.
Right. And here. I don't think there's anything wrong with it per se. There's just not necessarily a lot that's so right about it that we're now talking about it 50 years later. Sal Buscema was sort of a journeyman artist during this period. You know, he's a very great, very, very storied illustrator and, you know, cartoonist. And in this period, people had discovered that one of the things he was really good at, this was the days of what we now call the Marvel method, where basically you wouldn't write a full script. The writer would at most come up with a plot outline or a general shape of things. And then the artist would draw the pages, and the writer would then come back afterwards and fill in all of the copy. And that meant that your pencilers had to have good storytelling instincts, because they weren't really being told what's on page one, what's on page two, what's on page three. More or less, they were getting the back of the paperback description and going, you got 20 pages, do that and everything else, and having to figure it out as they go. Sal proved himself to be very adept at that, and very quick. And so in most months during the 70s, he would do breakdowns on like four books every month. Crazy number of books, because that skill was so valued. So the final finished art was often left in the hands of the inkers and the finishers, some of whom were better at it than others. Mike Esposito, I have to say, is not a terribly complimentary finisher for Sal. And so a lot of this art has...
There's some rough lines in this work, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, has what I can only describe as a coloring book look to it, where it's very open and a very broad line and not a whole lot else going on. It's not the best looking Sal Buscema job that you'll see from this era. It's just, it literally is a, you know, we have 30 days and we need to fill 20 pages. Let's go. This meets the minimum standard, but probably not a whole heck of a lot beyond that.
Sure. Mark, is this an issue you had read before?
No, never read it before.
Were you familiar with the villain, the Griffin, before?
I've never read a Griffin story before.
This guy has a wild history. I will likely do a character.
Wild look, too. Yeah. And I like the fact that, like, when he's on the surgery table, you can kind of see, as a man, what, you know, how he, that is, his features were just exaggerated by like 100. He would become the Griffin. Maybe wonder what I would become if I was ever the subject of such a horrifying operation.
One of the many Marvel books I would love to write someday is like a year-long exploration of Beast's adventures at the Brand Corporation, where we go back to that early days when he was wearing like latex masks after his horrid transformation, but he's fighting the Secret Empire and he's got an evil girlfriend named Linda Donaldson, who's amazing. There's some really fun content there, I think, that can be fantastically explored from a modern lens. But the Griffin first shows up there. He's a guy named Johnny Horton, who's a thug, and he kind of signs up for a procedure and wakes up with lion paws and claws and a lion mane and like wings grafted onto his back. Writing or seeing like Philip Kennedy Johnson write this character as like a horror character, right? Like, if you get the right artist, this is a really violent, awful transformation for this villain. Two things I do not love about this book, and we'll point out the problems before we jump in. There's like four times when they call him either fruitcake or cupcake, and anytime we get like a word we would use toward an effeminate man as like an insult from a superhero, it's a huge thing we see in this era, but I really dislike especially fruitcake. They use it multiple times to insult. Second, the Griffin, they just are so violent toward. I get he's a supervillain, but I want to see like Ryan North writing Squirrel Girl handling the Griffin. Like, she would find a reason to be like friends and like get him to a doctor, but instead they're just gonna punch him as much as possible. It's a really beautiful cover. We get Spider-Man fighting the Griffin, kind of straddling him while like webbing his wings, and Beast coming up behind him with like swinging up on a flagpole. Oh, it's a Ron Wilson cover. Really beautifully drawn, I think. I think it's fantastic. The Beast looks really dynamic here. As we jump into the story, the story is called The Night of the Griffin, and we see Spider-Man swinging home from a day of capers in the rain, and I want to see like the micro machines guy reading this guy's dialogue. He is talking to himself so much. And if you, it's just his ADHD is out of control. Home, that's where this soggy Spider-Man's heading. And the smiling weathercaster on ABC News is going to get one heck of an angry fan letter for predicting clear skies as soon as I dry out enough to write him one without soaking the paper. Whoops, hold on, Parker, old boy. The old Spidey sense and the good Lord have given one radioactive arachnid is tingling like crazy. He just is talking at super speed so much and happens upon a man being thrown out of a window. This is kind of an old scientist who's wearing orange and green. He's falling to his death in the rain. Spidey tries to save him. His web snags and like breaks. He's got to get in again. And then they swing both of them into the side of a barge. Perhaps not Spidey's finest moment. He catches the guy and then crashes into a ship. And then they both disappear beneath the water with a sploosh. This man that got thrown out maybe could have been rescued more effectively. Mark, did you have thoughts on kind of the comedy of these early scenes?
Yeah, it seems like mostly devoted to it. I mean, there are times we get, like you mentioned, like the where he's talking about the weather service for like five panels. You know, it's like a lot of the dialogue has nothing to do with the story or any sort of character interactions. It's all just sort of like a chance for him to, you know, make weather jokes or wisecracks. Or the other one where I found this actually impressive is when they were talking about canceling him like an old rerun, and they kept up like the bad TV sort of like bit, like references to bad TV shows for like two pages, you know, and it felt like they're in the midst of this battle, but all the dialogue is about like, you know, like sort of TV analogy for what they're doing to this, what they're doing to the Griffin, canceling him.
So Spidey pulls up out of the water with this dying doctor that he has caught, and Beast happens to be on the side. Beast is in his bouncy blue era. This is the era, well, shortly after this with the Defenders, I think, that the new Beast has come from that we see in kind of Jed's X-Men. It's this kind of bouncy blue hero Beast before he goes all dark and crazy. Can I lend you a hand, hero? If you don't mind the fur, that is. The ever beautiful, ever battling, ever loving, bludgeoning Beast at your service. Your Spider-Man, I presume? They've met before, but also maybe not when he's blue and furry. Spider-Man gives us a line about how he needs to come out of the water because this costume isn't guaranteed against shrinkage, which is one of the many unfortunate jokes that we get to laugh at after Seinfeld made that word more infamous. Beast is very, very chatty. Your wishes, my etc. Spider fellow. By the way, I hope I'm not being impertinent and asked, but do you always go for midnight swims in the East River? So there's just a lot of just punchy back and forth between these two. It's
I like how they both sound like they work at the Playboy Mansion or something. You know, both sound, like I expect them both to be like wearing like smoking jackets, you know, as they're delivering these lines.
Right,
good fellow. You know,
this man got tossed out of a window and is dying, and we're in the rain, but let's trade quips for a while. You know, sometimes you see your heroes making odd decisions.
It's all sort of smug, chummy humor too. It's really, I can understand that that's, you know, what they thought kids really wanted was this sort of smug, like Playboy Mansion type humor, but it just is a weird tone for them. And what makes it kind of strange is that they're both talking now. They're both, the voice of both characters when they're doing their bonhomie, their banter, are virtually indistinguishable.
It's very Hugh Hefner in its own way, for sure. Again, this could be, it's comedic here, it's simple superhero, but this could be a horror story. So the scientist is dying in the rain, and he takes time to explain how he was the scientist who helped transform Johnny Horton into the Griffin. Here's where we'll slow down just a little bit. The Secret Empire is literally a Ku Klux Klan version of like the Nazi Empire on the United States soil. Marvel heroes are always punching Nazis. They're literally wearing robes with numbers on the foreheads. It's an uncomfortable old group. And this is the story. This is the group where all the mutants get strapped into the wheel in that Captain America story because they're trying to use mutant energy to power up a world-conquering device. Again, there's a crazy history to explore here between the Secret Empire and the X-Men. But we see a hooded man watching this scientist perform the surgery on Johnny Horton, who's laying strapped to the table with a gas mask on. And this first image shows the scientist putting something on him. Tom, what are your opinions on this ball of yellow goo in the scientist's hand?
I don't know that I have a specific opinion about the ball of yellow goo, to be perfectly honest. I didn't make much of it other than it's a typical flashback. I guess that's what they made the wings and the claws and things out of.
Mark, any theories?
Yeah, when I saw it, I thought, well, this is like some sort of cartilage paste or something or stem cell stuff that sort of will organically take the form of whatever you're trying to make.
It's a pureed griffin.
Pureed griffin. It's fancy piece.
It looks to me like, again, sort of reverse engineering things here, that probably Bill's plot description to Sal was, and then we flash back to the Secret Empire, the guy in the Secret Empire turning him into the griffin and the specificity of it was pretty vague, and Sal didn't know what the heck to draw. So this is what we ended up with. The whole opening of this, I think, is a fairly classic example of, like, literally, not even figuratively, literally, a story falls out of the sky on Spider-Man. The other superhero who happened to have fought the Griffin last time, and the only other one he has any real history with, happens to be waiting for Spider-Man on the pier to pull him out by total coincidence. Like, this is the sort of thing that would not pass the smell test today, but at the time, you know, it got you into the story by, like, page two.
Blame Franklin Richards for anything. His powers are subconsciously manipulating events across the world. That's my theory. So Johnny Horton is not a character off, but one of the recurring themes we see with him is he is a human who was transformed into a griffin. Part of it seems to be a major surgical procedure. They've literally gotten wings from somewhere and planted them on this man's back. He started as a Caucasian guy, but his skin, his face is like white and pallid. And then they've grafted somehow like a full lion's mane around his face, which is the most ridiculous part, as well as lion paws. So he's muscular. He's in a very odd costume with the huge, like, heavyweight champion belt. Part of this character's theme, though, is there is a serum involved, which is something that parallels the Beast's story in an interesting way, because he has drunk a serum that causes him to further mutate. So between appearances and Amazing Adventures, and here he has grown a massive tail. He is also super strong at this point. And we later see him, for one example of this, in the Namor series.
Yeah.
He continues mutating and becomes the Submariner's, steed for a while.
Yeah, kind of an unfortunate thing even at the time, but looking back on it even sort of more so.
There's a number of Marvel villains that are like people turned by scientists into some sort of animal hybrid, and this is one of the most horrible. The Armadillo comes to mind. Do you guys have any favorite, like, Marvel villains who've been turned into something? The Hippo's the reverse version, right? He's a hippo made into a human villain. But yeah, do you have any favorites in that category?
I think certainly, the Rhino comes to mind as sort of the quintessential version of that, particularly in the years when he couldn't take the costume off, which sort of raised the question, what does he do with his bodily waste? But, it was the comics code. We didn't have to touch on that in those days.
There's a couple of gnarly ones in the Serpent Society, like Bushmaster, who had a snake tail grafted onto him, or like Death Adder, whose like mouth is missing afterward. Mark, do you have any favorites?
I mean, I'm trying to differentiate in my mind the ones who just are half animal by, natural or by mutant means, or the ones that were turned into animals by scientific villain or villainy. And I'm having a hard time differentiating. I'll have to think about it.
So the griffin attacks the scientist who once mutated him. We get flashbacks of him being trapped in a cage, developing his tail, which is prehensile, but also like really spiky and kind of demonic looking, lashing out, waking up in the hospital. He says, "I have no wish to be human anymore. I am the griffin and all mankind is my prey." So Beast, I think, would have a certain amount of empathy being once transformed by a serum in a similar way, but instead Beast is doing things like, "I think you should consider a new mouthwash, fruitcake." We get a lot of those types of lines. So the scientist that he initially threw out the window dies. The griffin swoops in to attack and he wants to go after the Secret Empire. But after we learn this origin, the scientist is dead, which is abrupt for a mid-70s comic. And now we have the griffin flying into attack, but he has one additional superpower, and this is the craziest part of this book, perhaps. Mark, do you want to talk about the griffin's army?
God, it was just like out of left field. It was like, what? And it makes sense in a weird sort of Silver Age way that, oh yeah, of course, the Griffins could have an army of other flying creatures. But the seagulls just seem kind of like, well, this is just what he felt like drawing. Or this is...
someone had seen random. Birds recently. If you guys recall the original movie, The Birds, there's a bunch of...
Oh, now that makes sense. That makes more sense. Like riffing on The Birds is like makes much more sense in that scene than the plot of the story itself.
It's hilarious. So he's swooping in and just saying, I control all things in the sky, which is later a Sam Wilson thing to be able to control all the birds. We get a close-up of the griffin's face. He looks truly vampiric. He says, my seagulls will continue to attack you until the flesh is torn from your bones, mutant. He's the master of all that fly, he said. And there's a relatively savage battle as the griffin continues to order them to, you know, slash the costume buffoon, my pets, tear his mocking words from his throat. As Spidey's distracted by the flock of seagulls, the literal ones, not the haircut, the Beast and the Griffin are grappling in midair. Beast is being very, very quippy, even as he's being choked to death by the Griffin's tail, which is always a hilarious thing for me. It comes across as very phallic. It makes me think of that character Gregory Wright brought in, the Priapus with the giant red penis tail from the 90s. It gives the energy. The Beast is drowning under the water, being choked by the tail, until Spidey's able to jump on the Griffin's back, calling him Paste Face. The battle goes aerial again as they're whopping him in the head multiple times. There's a hilarious image of Beast body slamming or like belly flopping onto the water with a splash. I don't know if you guys have ever belly flopped and you get those like welts on your stomach afterward. Mm-hmm. Mark, did you have any comments on this kind of aerial battle in the rain?
Oh yeah, it's very acrobatic. I think it's probably the best art in the issue, just because there's so much kinetic energy going on there. I don't know why we need the rain. The rain feels a little unnecessary, and it probably added more time on than they really wanted to devote to drawing this, other than to facilitate the jokes that Spider-Man tells at the beginning about the Weather Bureau. But I think if that was the reason, then he really wrote himself into a corner, because rain just sort of detracts from the acrobatic fight in the air that transpires.
I think it's an interesting visual. I'm friends with a couple of Marvel artists. Philip Seed is a dear friend of mine. I know Philip will try to find ways to like challenge themselves as an artist sometimes to try to find new ways to make the dynamic work. So the rain is an interesting visual.
Yeah, because there's zero reason for it to be raining other than the initial jokes. It just sort of happens to be raining.
So Spidey jumps on Griffin's back, is riding him like a steed and like holding the wings in his hands. And again, we get, have you ever considered making commercials, Cupcake? You know, like, I'm Griffy, fly me. And Griffin is losing his mind. This is one of Spidey's things, is he distracts people with humor. Beast barrels after them across the rain. It leads to a battle over a bridge. The Griffin is ready to kill. He wants revenge on the evil Nazi scientists, right? Like, I kind of understand. He swats Spidey down. Spidey catches a web on a bridge. There is traffic everywhere. People are honking and beeping. The Griffin swoops back in one last time. You still exist to plague me. This time I will destroy you both once and for all time. And both heroes work together in tandem to swing forward on the bridge and kaplow him in the face all at the same time. This is what finally defeats him, is a double punch from Spidey and Beast. Tom, is this a satisfying conclusion to this aerial battle?
I think it probably is. We stopped bothering with plot about 10 pages earlier. like very, very much a hallmark of a lot of the Marvel books of this period is that what story there was really there to facilitate the fight, and the fight was the actual event. So once you get to the point where we've and I think more than anything, that's why the scientist dies on that pier. He's given you all the exposition he can give you. There's nothing left for him to do. He's just going to be an impediment from this point on. So if he dies, Spidey and the Beast can go chase after the Griffin without having to get him to medical attention or deal with him in any way, shape, or form. He's done his job, which is deliver exposition and then get off stage. So the fight is kind of it's nice enough. It's sort of by the numbers. It ends in a nice big image of both Spidey and the Beast simultaneously hanging on the bridge and punching out the Griffin. So you at least get some catharsis there. I don't know that it's the best fight scene ever in a Marvel comic. I don't know that it was the best scene in a Marvel comic fight scene that month. But it reaches the minimum requirements. It does the job. It gives you some feeling of catharsis. Yeah, in terms of a story, not a lot of story here.
So there's a man's body. His Griffin Griffin body is unconscious on the ground. And again, these are superheroes. If I heard cops or like doctors talking like this, I would be horrified. Spider-Man says, "Phew, ever since Beam got elected mayor, trash collecting in the city has been horrendous." And Beast says, "Perhaps they didn't realize that he was garbage." The police arrive to take him away. You know, they're like, "We got to take the bad with the good at this job." Beast gives one last, "Well, he might make a good planter." Just, you know what? This is a human being. I know he's a bad person, but my word. Okay, then we get the best scene in the comic book, which is the last page. In my opinion, Mark, this woman knows Granny Smite. You're going to bring her back in an X-Men book somewhere. There's an old woman. Mark, do you want to describe her clothing?
It's sort of like if you're dressed up as like a rich widow at like a costume party. She's got like a fur like stole and what looks like it's a hat, but it looks almost like a tiara almost. And then like a scepter. She literally has a scepter. Or no, it's an umbrella, but it's an umbrella made to look like a scepter.
Yeah, so this is a rich, like probably a widow, but like the fancy lady with way too much money who feels inconvenienced. Yeah. We're going to name her Karen because how could we not? And she says, "Ahem, just a moment, officers." Her chauffeur says, "Madam, quiet Renfrew, I must ask you not to interfere." The cop says, "What's the problem, lady? It's late and we'd all like to go home." So precisely, these ruffians have halted traffic for nearly 15 minutes while going on with their childish brawl, making me late for a very important dinner engagement. Madam, will you desist, Renfrew? I simply must demand restitution from these vigilantes for my delay. But madam, what is it, Renfrew? Out with it, man. And he confesses that it was actually his fault about the traffic jam because he forgot to change a faulty tire and now they have a flat. It won't happen again. You are correct, Renfrew, it won't. You are herewith discharged. Now fix that tire and take me home. City air is so bad for my sinuses. Spider-Man says, "You forgot something, lady. Like an apology to us ruffians." And he webs her feet while Beast basically high-fives him. Way to go, web spinner. Renfrew! Yes, madam. Don't just stand there. Release me. I cannot, madam. Why on earth can't you? You fired me, madam. Don't you remember? So this is hilarious, but also the real-world implications of this. They webbed an old woman's feet to make her stand in the rain for a couple of hours.
Like, wow. Yeah, yeah.
This is like when Spidey webs J. Jonah Jameson's mouth at the window of the Daily Bugle, right? Did you guys have any thoughts on this final scene? It made me laugh pretty hard, actually.
It's a silly bit of business and very much sort of, again, of its era. It's very broad comedy. You know, this woman is not a character. She's a type. And her getting her comeuppance, it doesn't really have anything to do with anything in the story before this. It's just some weird local color to give you a laugh and a lighter moment to go out on. It's sort of typical of the kind of thing that you see in Spidey comics of this era, although usually over there it was probably done a little better and a little more about Spider-Man as a New York character and the feeling of what New York was like as a living environment and so forth. So I don't think it's terrible. I don't think it's good either. Again, it doesn't hold up to the slightest bit of scrutiny. Our theoretical superheroes are kind of both just jerks here, at least as big a bunch of jerks as the woman who's complaining about being held up in traffic and not listening to her chauffeur.
But I mean, they're just bullies at this point. Yeah, but it's funny. It's interesting to remember that long before Wolverine was a breakout star, he did exist at this time, but Beast was kind of the first breakout star from the X-Men. Oh, he has his own logo on the cover here. He was originally intended as a horror story, kind of, and I think Griffin as a horror character has a lot of interesting potential. Mark, did you have any final thoughts on this story?
Yeah, well, I want to briefly just talk about that end scene, because I think it sort of combines two things that were very common in the 70s. One is like the rich elite person, snooty person getting pushed into a pool or finally getting their comeuppance, which is weird because this lady shows up out of nowhere. She was not present in any of the story before this final page and just shows up basically to get dunked on by Spider-Man. And then the other thing is sort of the anti-vigilante like sermon used against the heroes who you've seen, you know, like conquer this villain. And then some, usually the police commissioner or someone complains that you're violating their human rights. You don't understand, commissioner. But it felt like a weird combination of those two sorts of cliches from the 70s, the anti-vigilante sermon and the Mr. Howell, the Thurston Howell the third type, getting pushed into a pool for being a snob. And they thought, why not both? And just sort of crammed them both in there. So it's a very weird way to end it. But I think one thing that really struck me about the issue as a whole was the really loose pacing. It feels like you've got Dostoevsky-esque pacing for what is basically like an elongated fight on a bridge or over the water. And they spent, I remember when I read this, like just sort of stopping and marveling. I went back and counted the pages, like how long it took just to show the opening scene of Spider-Man rescuing the guy, the scientist, or falling off the bridge or falling through the sky. That scene took 6 pages. That was like, I was almost envious. It's like, oh, if I could spend 6 pages on a single scene, any scene, that, you know, that could be something really great. But, you know, it was really kind of the service of, you know, like Tom pointed out, almost zero plot. These enormous scenes in which nothing really happens other than the kinetic action of the artwork itself.
This is an interesting experiment, too. I have a lot of creatives that listen to the show. If you want to practice comic book scripting, take an issue like this that's relatively self-contained and reverse engineer it. Type out a full script format of a story like this. Page one, it's this many panels. You describe what's happening in each scene and type out the dialogue. Watch how long it takes to put together, even on a relatively simple story. And then take something like Giant Size X-Men number one, or, you know, any book in Krakoa where the word count and all of the text pages, like it's so in depth and strung together. The responsibility of superheroes is another interesting theme here that we won't take too seriously, but they left a corpse on one dock, dumped a supervillain in the middle of a traffic jam, webbed an old lady up, and were like, bye cops, we gotta go home now. The fact that they didn't have to stay to make a statement is crazy. You understand why J. Jonah Jameson fucking hates Spider-Man if you read this story.
Well, so the cops have something like are they able to dissolve Spider-Man's web? Do they have
that woman has to wait the hour.
Or whenever Spidey like hangs someone for a lamp, they just have to like wait underneath, hopefully, otherwise this man falls to the pavement below.
Yeah. They got an hour to like put a mattress down.
Words with great power come great responsibility does not mean like civic duty or when it comes to Spidey. Well, this is a silly, fun story. It's fun to place this era of the Beast in his kind of Avengers craziness. It's a really fun character. And nice job, Bill Mantlo, on a filler issue. It's ultimately just a good time in a long run of fun team-up comedies. But again, this is a horror book would be the most interesting. So we're going to put this out, gentlemen, on June 9th. Where can people find you both online? Is there anything you would like to plug? You can follow the show most easily at graymalkin_lane on Instagram. The episode coming out after this is another weird journey in the mid-70s. We're covering Rampaging Hulk number 2, which is a crazy journey about the original X-Men fighting the Hulk, except it's not. It's a movie production on an alien planet. We'll get there. It's Mojo before Mojo. the hosts of Escape the Mojoverse, the podcast, are joining me for that. Watch for the Trial of Moondragon later this month, one of my all-time favorite characters. And over on the Patreon, we're doing all queer characters to celebrate Pride Month. So Sarah Century and Joe Jones joined me for an episode about the incredible supervillain Mankiller, Katrina Luisa Van Horn. Go read the Scum Manifesto and then hear us talk about lesbian politics in the early 70s. It's going to be a great time.
You can find me on my website, markrussellbooks.com, or on Blue Sky. And my handle is Manruss, M-A-N-R-U-S-S, both on Blue Sky and on Instagram. And in terms of plugging stuff, I would like to plug the aforementioned X-Factor number 1, volume 1, Please Like and Share, available in stores now. Also, the collected series Traveling to Mars is finally in book form in fine bookstores everywhere. And in my new series, Vanishing Point, which is sort of a sci-fi anthology series. It's sort of like if they had let me write The Twilight Zone, this is what I would have done. Issue number 1 just dropped on Wednesday, so, and you don't even have to read issue number 1. You know, issue 2 is a completely different story. So please check it out.
I'm watching The Twilight Zone in real time for the first time ever. I've been watching like an episode a day the last month. It's really fun. It's so good, even all these years later. I just saw Rod Serling at the end of an episode go, a lot of people accuse me that I'm not good at writing stories for women. So come back next time where a woman's going to write a story. It's like, oh God,
about it's me. 50s.
And Tom.
Well, I have my newsletter every week at Substack, Tom Brevoort, .substack.com. I have TomBrevoort.com. The webpage. You can find me on most any social media platform, usually using the words Tom and Brevoort in some combination. And in the pages of a bevy of X-Men titles every single month.
I love the term conductor of X, by the way. I think it's really charming. And your newsletter remains a bright spot every week.
Thank you.
Good to see see you both. I'm so happy to have had this time. And it was fun to see the two of you hang out together. It's always fun to put different combinations of people together. So thank you for listening, everybody. Happy Pride. Make sure you are celebrating yourselves, even in places that tell you you should not. Do it safely, do it carefully, but don't dim your light for any reason in this world. It is important to shine bright, especially now. Thanks, everybody. Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Mark. We will see you all back here next time on the Grey Malkin Lane Show.
Thank you for listening to Grey Malkin Lane. We hope you are enjoying this podcast. Grey Malkin Lane is produced and recorded in Salt Lake City, Utah, with music and editing done by my husband, Michael Bell, and promo art done by the incredible Seth Martell. Look for us on Patreon, where we are releasing weekly episodes about obscure characters and facts. It's a great way to participate with the podcast for only just a couple of dollars a month, and it helps support what we are doing here. Also, the best way you could help Grey Malkin Lane is by sharing and liking and subscribing, but also please leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. We'll see you back here next time on Grey Malkin Lane.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week.
Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.